Interview with Ted Levine at Wachtell Lipton in New York City, July 25th, 2006, by Kenneth Durr.
Thanks for agreeing to talk to me. I want to chat a little bit about your background, how you came to the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Actually, I was. It's relevant to insider trading because in law school at George Washington University, Henry Manny was my professor at the time, and I was taking a corporations course, and he recommended me to Stan Spork in the summer of 1968. And I was a summer intern in my second year of law school, working in the Division of Trading and Markets at the time. And then in 1969, when I graduated law school, I thought I was going to be drafted. Turned out I wasn't, and I joined and got a permanent position with the commission, although I wasn't really intending to go there. I thought I was going into the Army. Ended up staying from 1969 till I left in the end of 83, 84, when I became a partner with Wilma Cutler and Pickering.
Well, tell me about that class with Henry Manny. He must have talked a lot about insider trading.
Well, it was a corporations class, so we spent a little time on it, and he was young. You know, he had his theory of, in defense of insider trading, he had written this book, which was that it was basically a way to reward entrepreneurial efforts of executives, and he was sort of really, it was on the outside. And that was right after Texas Gulf Sulphur had been decided in the Second Circuit. I think that was 1968, if I'm not mistaken. I did very well in corporations class, but it was really, he was, truthfully, it was almost 40 years ago, so I don't really remember. But it was, I do remember the fact that he had recommended me to Stanley, and you know, he had taken this extreme position. I was probably too young to appreciate what was right and what was wrong in that respect. But nonetheless, that's how I got started there.
Tell me about working for Stanley Spork and enforcement. These must have been pretty exciting times.
Well, it was really Irv Pollack and Stanley Spork, and at that time, thereafter, Irv moved up to commission, and they reconstituted what was called trading and markets into the Division of Enforcement, and they had the separate Division of Market Regulation set up. It was a very enforcement throughout until Stanley left in 1981, when actually John Shadd became chairman, and it was really enforcement was really the center of not only the enforcement work but all the development of mostly all the regulatory proposals at the commission. So basically all rule proposals or regulatory initiatives and even briefs that were being filed in the general counsel's office passed through enforcement. And so enforcement lawyers, including myself, had a role that, at least I did, that was greater than simply doing enforcement cases or supervising others. It was really having input into a lot of the regulatory structure. I remember there was a whole theory at the commission of a gestalt approach, which was to use enforcement but also develop rules around it. So the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act developed that way, the PERCS rules, disclosure compensation developed that way, the beneficial ownership rules and the tender offer rules all developed through first an enforcement action, then a vetting of rules around that idea. So it was a very exciting time, and we were involved in everything going on at the commission during in the enforcement days. Stanley, of course, was Stanley. He was and I was very close with him, and still am. But had a very important role in influencing the commission direction. And it's interesting, up to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, as a matter of history, the SEC was a rather sleepy organization. the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, because particularly the voluntary disclosure program, really put it on the map because it got huge visibility, and thereafter was that was 1976. That whole era, it was post Watergate, and it became much more focused and therefore much more controversial as a result of it being a higher profile.
The commission got into some controversy, as you mentioned, with Texas Gulf Sulphur in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the legacy of that and what kind of civil insider trading cases.
Three things. There are several things that were themes that I recall from my enforcement days. First of all, Stanley concentrated at some point with really me and Ed Hurley. What we did is we set up different units within the enforcement division, and one of the things we focused on was to concentrate insider trading cases with us. The theory was that not to have an ad hoc program, but to have a programmatic approach. So you want to bring a series of insider trading cases, and by the way, the enforcement division was much, much, much smaller. And so while the others one could be brought within the whole, either the home office or the regional offices of the commission, is try to have a concentration in one group in order to have the expertise to deal with them. And one of the things we did is we had that insider trading. Second of all, there, because of Katie Roberts and Texas Gulf Sulphur, there was the sense of the discipline necessary, or the parsing of the, and also, I might add, the investment management case, the Merrill Lynch case, Donald Douglas case, which happened in 1970, I believe. All that was, basically, there wasn't that much thought, whether it was a parity of information theory or, you know, basically insiders couldn't trade. You didn't have the duty analysis and all the stuff that followed Chiarella. The law was not really the issue. The issue was, could you make the factual case and develop it? So one is, I think it was really this concentration. Two, there wasn't a civil penalty at the time, so it was an injunction and disgorgement. And the theory of enforcement at that time was really not to punish, but to bring the case and improve, have a deterrent effect and improve business standards. The philosophy of enforcement has shifted with John Shadd. While there was tough enforcement, it was a broad program, and it wasn't a punitive program. So basically, the enforcement cases were used to remedy the problem and put in constructive fixes. It wasn't designed to punish, and it was really thought that there was no civil penalty, and bringing a case and getting it out publicly so people could see it would have the deterrent effect. Plus, you'd have an injunction, and you'd deprive the violator of ill-gotten gains.
This is under Shadd?
No, this is under Sporkin. Under Shadd, with this, you know, he's going to stomp on you with hobnail boots, all that stuff. It was a much narrower program, and it became punitive. And then in 1984, with the Insider Trading Sanctions Act, they got civil penalties for the first time under, in my view, the mistaken theory that you had to be tougher in order to deter people from violating. I don't think it actually was the case, and people, even with the tougher penalties, it hasn't deterred people. People still trade. But in my view, one was, whether it's parity of information or an easy standard, there wasn't really legal analysis brought to bear. Two, you had this concentration. And three, you wanted to publicly reveal the problems, and in order to get the effect of, essentially, you wanted to say, this is not acceptable conduct, and if you do engage in insider trading, this is the consequence, which will be, you'll be enjoined, you'll have to give it the profit, you'll have the imprimatur or the opprobrium of the publicity, and the cases were getting higher visibility, you know, in terms of the newspapers.
Well, Now, because of that approach, did you pick and choose cases and say, let's go after these people because they're very visible?
No, I wish it was that simple. I mean, a lot, most of the cases that were brought were a result of market surveillance, and there was more reactive, because surveillance, just like today, you'd match news against trading. It was more rudimentary then because you didn't have the technology, but it was really, that was most of the way it would come up. You'd see active trading before.
And was this yet the SEC's market surveillance?
Yes. Yeah, market surveillance, there was a separate unit within the commission, a market surveillance unit within the enforcement division. It wasn't OC. Also, you got some referrals because of jurisdictional issues from the either the NASD or the exchange as well. But there was their own market surveillance. This is in the days when I started the commission, where we had in the market surveillance room the broad tape, but it was literally a piece of white paper that printed out. So if you wanted news events, you'd go out and cut it out of the broad tape and then scotch tape it back together. And we also had the ticker was also right there in the room, so you could watch every print on New York Stock Exchange. In fact, I think that probably still sits in the Director of Enforcement's office. They don't use it anymore, obviously, but that machine where it used to print out. And obviously, sometimes the news, if you ran out of paper and someone was going to change it, you would miss some of the on the broad tape. That's how rudimentary it was at the commission when I was there. Things obviously changed a lot since then.
Tell me a little bit about how you and Ed Herlihy did business, who you had working with you, how you provided the labor.
Well, it changed over time. I can't tell you. Somewhere, I think it was 3 years, so it would have been 72 I became a branch chief, and then maybe 75 or 76 I became an assistant director and then an associate director before I left. And Ed was one below me, became branch chief and assistant director, moved up. I don't recall who. Gary Lynch worked with us at one time. Down there, and a lot of Bill McLucas, actually most of the work in the area, but actually how we organized, I know we had two branches when I was an assistant director, and when I was an associate director, several. One of the branches, what we did, and it was not by way of picking people necessarily, it wasn't that sophisticated, just happened to have a branch chief and a number of attorneys, and we concentrated the cases there in terms of the investigations, coordinating with market surveillance. And I also think, I don't know if I had market surveillance reporting to me. I may have at one point in time. I don't recall. So we used to, basically the cases you get, you'd basically get the fact that there was an event. Later on in the 80s, particularly when the takeovers became more prevalent, you had a lot of M&A-related stuff. But in the early times, it could have been selling in advance of bad news, or buying in advance of good news, you know, those different type of cases. And my own sense, it was more corporate insiders and not, at that time, Wall Street, because I think the Wall Street phenomena came in mostly when they became advisors to M&A transactions. So it's pretty simple looking back now. You know, you'd look at the event, you'd get the blue sheet information, which took a while because it was manually supplied either to the SROs or the SEC. Then you'd go back to the brokerage firm and get the information about who was identified as the trader. And then you would start either through a formal or informal process getting in touch with that person. Also probably get a chronology from the company, and also try to identify who was who may have known about it if it was a transaction. Essentially, try to look at who was it. If it was an insider, you'd try to establish whether the person had access to the information. If it wasn't clear who the person was, then you would try to identify who there may be a relationship between someone who did know and the person who traded. And then if you could establish that, then you take testimony. A lot of those cases were settled. There was relatively few litigation at that time of insider trading cases.
Why is that?
is almost rarely ever a criminal case. Chiarello is the first criminal case, except for a short-selling case involving a guy named Peltz, who happened to be back in, I think. Two, there was no civil penalty at the time. So, what you were seeking was either an administrative or injunctive relief and disgorgement of ill-gotten gain. And so they were relatively easy to get rid of in that sense. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and most of the times these cases were settled, not litigated, because they were, without admitting and denying, that's still the mode in which people settle today. And as I said, the philosophy was to bring the case, have the public airing of it, and you would influence conduct and standards through that. And it was pretty highly successful. You know, the program, the SEC was viewed as the best enforcement program in the world, really, and it was emulated around the world.
So these were classic insiders, members of boards of directors,
officers, right, or employees.
Yeah. Did you ever get these more orchestrated groups that I know turned up in the 80s, where you've got people sharing information and brokerages?
I don't think it's hard for me to remember. The cases that I recall in the 70s were, I think, more plain vanilla cases. I think the events that changed everything, three things happened. Actually, maybe more than three things happened. But first, you had the shift in the Supreme Court. You know, the high watermark of the Supreme Court from the SEC standard was probably in the early 70s with the Affiliated Ute and the Affiliated Ute case, and also Superintendent of Insurance v. Bankers Life, where there was an expansive reading of 10b-5, and it was a very... And then, as you recall, Powell joined the court, Douglas left. There was this shift. Berger became the Chief Justice, and then you had a whole spate of cases. Aaron Hockfelder, loss of private right of action in Transamerica v. Lewis. You had the blue chip stamp case. You had a narrowing of the security laws. You also had, up to this point, a very favorable Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit. Besides being a very sophisticated court, you also, one of the Second Circuit judges was Timbers, who was a former general counsel of the SEC. Douglas, having been the former chairman of the SEC, who carried a lot of weight on the Supreme Court, Timbers on the Second Circuit. You also had a very favorable D.C. Circuit. So this shift in the court and the narrowing of the expansive reading of security laws was an important development. Two, you had takeovers, which spawned, and it started in the 70s into the 80s, it spawned a much different approach. Three, you had the involvement of broker-dealers, investment banks, because of the takeovers. So you had that whole area. And four, you had the change in the chairman in 1981, from because Shad came in when Reagan won. Stanley left. Fetters became the head of enforcement. I know you either have or will talk to John. And those are all dramatic changes which impacted insider trading. Chiarella decision, it was 1980, right, or 81, I forget, was a huge change in how you approach this. But it was a combination of all that stuff that changed the program substantially, in my view. It was much more visible in insider trading cases. It had much more prominence. The chairman lopped on insider trading, Shad, in order to really basically cut back the enforcement program. Basically, it was a very expansive program. It was like having a cop on every corner. You never knew where, and also Shad was against naming broker dealers. He wanted to only name individuals. So what he did is he came out very strongly in focusing on insider trading, the famous quote of Hobnail Boots, I guess. And and that Breeden also, you know, he's going to essentially leave him homeless and clothesless or whatever it was. All that was designed to basically signal we're really going to be tough on insider trading cases. At the same time, you had one other event, which I should have mentioned in the 80s, was the unknown purchaser case, which happened when I was there, Santa Fe.
Okay, sure.
And that was an unprecedented. There was the one before that, but that was really an unprecedented case, where basically the commission authorized the suing of people who they didn't know, simply based on the fact that people had traded an out-of-the-money option shortly before expiration, shortly before the announcement of news. And they actually, they were successful in bringing the case and getting the court to lock up the profits. And also, you had, this really involved the foreign governments, particularly Switzerland, and there was the Banca della Saveria case before that, where I think which is a judge in New York threatened to bring the bank in, and it was a much, and that event also was critical. That first of all was a very expansive and not totally uncontroversial event. I was at the commission in Santa Fe. I was involved in it. The idea that we went to the commission and said we don't know who traded, we don't even know if they knew, but it must be because who else would buy out of the money call options right before expiration. And the commission authorizing that was really an extraordinary expansion of insider trading.
Whose idea was it to do that?
I don't recall exactly how it came up. I actually don't recall how it. But the evolution was, people believed that the people had to know who were trading, because there were large amounts of out-of-money options shortly before expiration. Two, they were foreign. They were bought through foreign entities. So you had, and three, the theory was, if you can convince a judge that that's circumstantial evidence enough, and once you tie up the assets, you'll force the people to come in. And that, basically, that's what happened.
How do you do that?
Well, you had to file a complaint, basically, as I recall, and basically, and this is 25 years ago, basically said, you know, this unknown purchaser, like a John Doe case, had to have inside information, and we need, and basically you seek a TRO, or temporary relief, to tie up the assets so they wouldn't leave the account, because if we were correct, had they left, they would have been dissipated. And then you try to use, And by the way, at the same time was the development of the MOU with Switzerland, which this was when John Fetters, we were there, Ed Green, of trying to develop the ability to get access to the underlying records. And that was a challenge also because, A, you had Swiss secrecy. B, you had the fact that insider trading was not a crime in Switzerland, although they later amended the statute. So you and the law, unless there's you could demonstrate a crime, it wouldn't allow access to this confidential information. But there was a lot of pressure brought to bear. Ultimately, there's this memorandum of understanding which was negotiated, which allowed under the certain standards, I don't recall the details of it, but the ability to get access to these records upon a certain showing there.
Did that grow out of the Santa Fe case?
Well, I think it probably did. I'm not, because there's the timing. That actually, I think, probably was finished in 84, 83. You may know better than I do the timing. But I think if it didn't grow out exactly, it did come out of very close because it was related. And the frustration of people going overseas to purchase or sell and not having access to it was there.
So was the idea that you lock up the assets and wait for the person whose assets they were to come and try to...
Right, forced to come in, right, because you're essentially tying up all the capital. And it was pretty successful. One footnote, there was a huge amount of litigation over how you divide up the profits, which were... there was separate... I think if you'll find, and I'm not as familiar with the details, But there was in the second circuit there was litigation over the who gets the assets here in the claims. It was very complicated litigation as to, because disgorgement normally is you probably give it to the person who was defrauded on the other side of the transaction. And by the way, I recall that there was a lot of controversy over the how you deal with that. And, you know, there was no fair funds provisions, none of the stuff now with Sarbanes-Oxley. There it was much, and there the SEC used to take the position, I should say also, that it was not, it did not have a mission of restitution. On the theory, a court in equity, if got jurisdiction because of the injunctive relief, in its equitable powers, it could, among other things, deprive the violator of ill-gotten gain. That's the theory of disgorgement. It's an equitable remedy. The commission always took the position that that was its purpose, not to provide restitution to the defrauded party. They left it to the private parties. That's gotten a lot merged these days. The philosophy has changed. Fair funds is sort of the latest example of that.
What was behind that philosophy?
Well, the philosophy was it wasn't a collection agency. It certainly worked to help investors, and disgorgement would do it, but it was really religious to the principle that it isn't a court in equity, and it was really to deprive the violator of the gain, which is made available then, but it relied on the private bar and to really represent the investor.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, but now that's got more merged. The SEC's taken more of a restitution type of approach, part by fair funds, because there was criticism. You know, when you had hundreds of millions of dollars of disgorgement, you don't put in a treasury while investors get nothing. So it's sort of, that's what the whole theory of the Sarbanes-Oxley and fair funds is.
Was that partly due to in the 80s when the amounts got so much?
Yeah, larger? Part of it's in that, but the 80s is much different because one, you had option trading. Two, you had the Insider Trading Sanctions Act. And even though the statute said up to three times the gain or the loss avoided, the commission adopted as a philosophy in all settled cases one-time penalty. They then merged into prejudgment interest, which was fought over. But so you would then have a million dollar profit give up plus $1 million penalty, which is not going to investors at the time. It's going to the Treasury. Plus you're getting prejudgment interest, maybe. So it became much more expensive. That was this theory of ratcheting up the penalty. They started... Two, you had... The law was screwed up. Insider trading.
The Insider Trading
Sanctions
Act?
No, the law generally. The law of insider trading became really screwed up in the 80s, post-Chiarella.
Yeah, well... Yeah.
Well, Chiarella, with its majority concurring opinions, basically said you have a duty. So the duty analysis took over. Because of 1483, you had they covered tender offers, and what you had developed in the 80s is you had this, everyone started doing this duty analysis. And then you had Dirks. And I might say Dirks was a big shock to the commission. Because you had, I believe it was Skelly Wright, in the D.C. Circuit, wrote a very strong decision in support of the commission's position that Dirks had violated. And then he got overturned, his decision at the Supreme Court, and they put in I think it was 84, was Dirks, someone like that, they put in this whole theory of personal benefit. So you had a duty analysis, you had Dirks on personal benefit, and then you had this anomaly which came out of the U.S. v. Newman and Morse v. Morgan Stanley, where you could prosecute someone criminally. U.S. v. Newman was a case where I think it was Morgan Stanley or Lehman guys got tipped people and they traded, and because the theory was if you have a breach of duty in connection with the purchase and sale, or violation of trust and confidence, that's a violation of 10b-5. But Morse v. Morgan Stanley, a Second Circuit decision, threw out the private litigation on the theory that the person who was defrauded was the investment bank, not the shareholders on the other side. The fraud was stealing it, misappropriating it from the investment banks. They were the defrauded party, but they weren't a purchaser or seller, so they didn't have any private right of action. So you had this anomalous situation where you could prosecute someone criminally from the U.S. Department of Justice or SEC, but you didn't have a cause of action on the same facts because the person wasn't defrauded. That was the aftermath of Chiarella, and I recall that this was a big controversy in the bar. I did a lot of speaking at PLI and other programs. Everyone used to ferret out, what does this all mean, you know, in that sense. But there was also, there was a case where Gary Lynch and I brought, involving Tom Reed, who was the deputy head of Secretary of Defense. I don't know if you spoke to Gary yet, if you mentioned that yet.
What?
And we got chastised on the Hill because we settled the case civilly with an order and the disgorgement of profits. And we, D'Amato was the senator. We got called up there and criticized for being so weak on insider trading. And
he got another shot at it.
Yeah.
Another administration official.
Yeah. But the truth was, it was Thrasher, maybe not Reed. I forget which name. Was it Reed?
Yeah, it was
Tom Reed. His father was at SoCal, I think. Or one, and his father, the allegation was his father mentioned something about a takeover. He went out and traded. And that also raises a different thing, is really misappropriating it from an apparent relationship, which, you know, because the Chessman case, that also became a very controversial thing. When is it that you actually violate in the family relationship? Is there a level of trust and confidence? And there was a whole series of funny cases where husband is involved in a merger, his wife's sick in bed, having a child, and husband tells wife, I'm going to be tied up because of this merger activities. Wife inadvertently tells her brother who trades, so the wife, there was all these convoluted cases that come out all over the lot.
Well, the Thayer case was similar to that.
Thayer was the other case. The other big event in the 80s, part because of 14E, but part because of the pressure, was this essentially what was then known as Chinese walls and restricted and watch lists, now became known as informational barriers. It became imperative that every broker-dealer, and this is before 15F, every broker-dealer had to adopt Chinese wall procedures. It actually started in the 70s with Slade v. Shearson Hamel. It was a Second Circuit decision, or Southern District decision, and that issue was exactly what can a multifaceted investment bank do, where you have one group of people who has information and yet there's trading going on and customer relations on the other side. And actually, I represented Merrill Lynch in Cotton v. Merrill Lynch, which was a Oklahoma district court where that issue was prevalent. There was a case where an insider, a director, who was on the outs of the board, wasn't aware that the board was considering essentially a merger. He went to Merrill Lynch, who was the investment bank on one side, and unsolicited wanted to sell stock and sold it at X. Then the merger was announced, stock went to Y. He sued Merrill Lynch and others, saying, you had a duty to tell me. Merrill Lynch's defense, we argued successfully, was, no, the law precludes that. The Chinese wall prevented it, and that was successful. And then there's the creditors committees. It came up in another context and when the bankruptcies in the 80s. Basically, then firms became preoccupied. I did a lot of work in the area when I was in private practice, with setting up Chinese walls, restricted and watch lists, and procedures in order to let them, in a multidisciplined firm, do a variety of business activities. And later in, I think it was 88, I forget when it came in, 15F codified that. It actually, as a matter of statute, required firms to have policies and procedures in place to prevent the passing of information. But this concept of Chinese walls went to, in part, coming out of the M&A area particularly, where you'd have the private side of the wall, basically the investment banking side, then you had the trading, and you had the, in addition to trading, you had customer transactions, and also you had this phenomena, which later ended, of pre-deal announcement arbitrage activity. So firms had, used to use a watch list, but firms, you had people out there trying to anticipate deals by, before announcement. After announcement, people arbitrage, you know, because the market always has a spread between the takeover price and what the market price is. That's the risk factor, whether the deal will take place. And so people used to trade that spread, but also they used to try to anticipate, and that was that actually later petered out. These ARBs used to go out there and try to buy up big positions, assuming that they would, you know, companies would be taken over.
Are these the run-ups that people were always seeing?
When I was in private practice, I represented Ivan Boesky in 1986. But, and part of that whole, Dennis Levine, Marty Siegel, Milken, Boesky was the issue of this leakage of information about deals. But I think part of it was the run-up was when you had activity before an announcement. When I was at the SEC, and even when I was in private practice, generally speaking, you had, and I just saw today's paper, HCA, this buyout. Just today, the SEC is investigating option trading prior to this public announcement of the buyout. All that, so that hasn't changed. This is now 30 years later. Normally, the run-up to suggest someone was buying. But the combination of the change in the law, the narrowing of the law, the prevalence of option trading, and the M&A, which provided a lot of opportunity for profit, all, I think, sort of created this rebirth, and actually probably why the government tried to move to be tougher standards. There were other factors as well, but those were the main factors.
Because this setting an example that people can be prosecuted.
Yeah.
Clearly, wasn't doing anything to stem this activity.
That's right. Well, there's a philosophy, which of law enforcement, murder, robbery. It happens all the time. You know, it's vigorously enforced. You got cops. It still happens. You know, I don't happen to share the philosophy that putting the deterrent effect of prosecuting people once in a while it might have an added effect. But I found most business people the opprobrium was being held in the community of someone charged with a violation as being the worst thing, and reputationally, you only ever get over that. It wasn't viewed as a badge of honor to be sued by the SEC and have, in the case, there are cases where you question. So Chiarella, just take Chiarella. That was an SEC settlement. I believe, I don't know if someone else confirmed this to you, that it was the Department of Justice, as opposed to the SEC, really wanted to go criminal on that.
That's right.
Turned out to be a mistake, but that was, the SEC had a $30,000 settlement. Disgorgement of profit, and it moved on. The fact that the Department of Justice pursued that, and the SEC has involvement once those cases, but basically it was the Department of Justice case. I assume Gonson would tell you that if you haven't spoken to him, he will. I think set the stage for that decision. Now, it was coming anyway, I think, because there was a narrowing of the interpretation of security laws. Some of the other cases Also, when the theory that you, if you prosecute criminally, you will scare people and you'll deter violations. It works to some extent, but I think it was overblown. And I might say, what is the consequence, like the civil penalties more generally, but even in insider trading cases? The SEC lost a fair amount of cases when they litigate. People, once you have a criminal prosecution or you have a higher civil penalty and the demand, it becomes much more demanding to settle, people tend to, particularly on the closer cases, where you can't establish exactly, maybe circumstantial evidence, people tend to litigate, and you lose sometimes. And the program, I think, suffered a little bit. Probably, it still won most of its cases, but it suffered a little bit from the fact that people litigated and won. And I might add also, and we can talk about it in a second, this whole question about whether insider trading should be defined or not. Particularly as people all over the country started getting involved, that is, prosecutors and the SEC officers, you didn't have this all focused in the Second Circuit, a sophisticated circuit. You had different circuits, Ninth Circuit, and you'd have crazy decisions. So it hurt the program because I think judges and the SEC, we'll talk about jury trials, but judges tend to, if I go to you and say, all I'm asking for you to do is give me an injunction, obey the law, don't violate again, plus the person violated, give up the ill-gotten gain, you get the government gets a benefit of the doubt, preponderance of the evidence. I think once you start putting in a civil penalty and the consequence of maybe criminal prosecution, subconsciously, judges put a greater burden on the government in proving their case. It becomes more like a clear and convincing standard. And so the result of all that is, I think, the downside of toughening up was that it became harder to prove the case in those cases that were litigated.
What's an example of that? Is there a case that sticks out?
Well, I can't give you... I mean, there was the Teicha case in the Second Circuit, which led to 10b-5-1, this whole debate about whether or not possession or use, did you have to show the person had it, or did you have to show the person actually used it? It came up in a circumstance where it was tax time, and the person said, "I have to sell because I have to pay my taxes. I need money. I need liquidity." At the same time, the company is doing badly, and he's selling in advance of the announcement of bad earnings. So the person had a reason not to trade, simply trade, but on the other hand, he possessed the information, arguably. But I can't give you the losses, but there were losses along the way all over, generally speaking, the enforcement program, because of toughening up. Still, 90% of the cases were settled, but the 10%, or 80%, the 10%, and that became even harder when you had the officer and director bar in 1988, when they got the additional remedies. The officer and director bar comes in, and more generally, civil penalty. The commission's program was changed from being prophylactic and remedial to punitive, and the attitude there is, if that's the case, it's tougher to tough to get your relief because the court it just could hold you to a higher standard as a prosecutor.
Now it would seem this was particularly difficult since there was no definition of.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. I was on the Harvey Pitt. I think it was in 80. I forget when it was 80. Actually, you may know. I wrote one note down about. There was a in 87. There was a committee formed by Harvey Pitt, who had been, Harvey?
Yeah.
And actually, there was a bill introduced, Senate Bill 1380. But I was on that committee, and we came up with a definition, insider trading.
Now, your committee was working with D'Amato?
Yeah, D'Amato and Regal, actually. And actually, it was... it basically codified everything the commission had. It codified Chiarella, Dirks, and basically it was a very broad bill. And I recall the SEC put out their own proposal in 1978, I think, in the same, I forget exactly when. It didn't go anywhere. The SEC was deathly afraid of the fact that somehow by codifying insider trading, it would lose the ability to pursue something, even though, in retrospect, I think it was a mistake. Or maybe neutral, but this was an attempt to basically give certainty, but expansive certainty. It was codifying everything there then. But that there was a lot of resistance to the SEC. They were worried, and I forget who was it. Breeden, let's see, 87. I don't remember who the chairperson was at the time. May have been Ruta. I forget exactly, but there was a lot of resistance. Cox was the chairman at when this came out. He had moved up as acting chairman, so I forget, Charles Cox. But anyway, it didn't get through. So you didn't have that. You didn't have a definition ever. There's still no definition. You had the sanction for insider trading through the Insider Trading Sanctions Act. You had 15F, which codified the requirement for Chinese walls. And they put around, you had the bounty provision. Are you aware of the bounty provision? There's a provision in the statute that they can pay up to 10% of the penalty to someone who essentially gives them a tip of inside trading. It's 21 Law JE. So so around the edges they dealt with this, but they never actually dealt with the definition itself.
Now, why didn't the Senate initiative go?
Because at that time you would, and still currently, it's very hard to get something through if the commission did not support it. They deferred to the agency. If they weren't supporting it, they wouldn't do it.
Was your group trying to get the agency moving on this?
I'm sure. Well, the idea was, look, this turmoil, post-Chiarella, post-Dirks, so let's get a definition so people know what the boundaries are about insider trading. One thing I also recall, I should have mentioned earlier, was the Switzer case, which exemplified the problems post-Chiarella. Barry Switzer was the coach of the Oklahoma football team. He was sitting in the stand. I remember that because we've dealt with this when I was at the commission. I think I was at the commission earlier when it was first brought. He was sitting in the stands, and an executive was talking about a deal. This is where the allegations what came out. He overhears it, goes out and trades, and the SEC sues him for insider trading. The court threw it out, ultimately, and this was the theory, I think. The theory was, it was not non-public because he had overheard the executive in the stands at a football game. And this is the kind of academic approach. If, in fact, he had stuck his head into the conversation, he would have violated. But if he overheard it and he was sitting there, he wasn't, because then it wasn't deemed to be in confidence or non-public. And that was I think it was a little hometown decision there, but I think that was the decision that really happened.
What about how does the personal benefit fit into that? Is this in that period where sort of
personal benefit would have been a personal benefit? Personal benefit would be, but the theory here was misappropriation, and personal benefit comes up where the motive of the tipper looms large post Dirks. And the court in Dirks basically said, if you're trying to get a pecuniary benefit or a reputational benefit or convey a gift to a friend, that's improper motives. In equity funding, Sechrist had a proper motive. He was trying to reveal a fraud, and so there was no improper motive. Because what that did is, of course, it said Dirks could selectively reveal it to people. And so it does defraud some people. Some people getting it, and so it didn't make any sense. But that was, and that theory. So on the tip, looking at the tip, where you have to say, is there a personal benefit? Most cases there is, but that plus misappropriation sort of injected this uncertainty into the statute.
You talked about in the 70s you said that you really didn't need to worry about legal theories and how you were going to adhere to legal theories. You just wanted to show that somebody was trading with inside information. Tell me a little bit about how that changed and when that changed. I mean, obviously Chiarella is a turning point here. But how did that affect day to day how you and the people you worked with did business? And how much did you think about this changing set of
I left in 84. End of 83, the SEC. Chiarella was 80. Dirks was 84, I believe, the Supreme Court decision. On the routine cases, it didn't change because you still had Texas Gulf Sulphur. Yeah.
Classic insider
who was trading or tipping. Those cases didn't change. In that sense, remember that I didn't have the personal benefit analysis. So basically, if the insider had the information and either traded or the tipped, it was pretty actionable. Where it became more challenging, particularly post Chiarella, was the circumstance where you had either a temporary insider, or you had others that were not insiders who had access to the information. And that really was major league important when you had the M&A area, because that's where you involved all these other persons. Just got to check one thing here.
In which you sat down and said, okay, we've got this case, this is going to be a difficult one, let's approach it differently.
I don't have that recollection, Ken, but as I said, the Santa Fe case, I do recall, because that was very different. That wasn't necessarily on the theory case, but it was a new approach to deal with this phenomena of offshore trading and not be able to get access to who the underlying owner of the securities were. Two things happened. I think there was a migration in the M&A area to 14E3 because 10B5 was the subject of that. It was a different standard. It was thought there was a negligence standard rather than, the Hockfeller-Sienta standard under 14E3. It was a negligence standard. Two, the language is more susceptible to making the case easier. Mm-hmm. So until O'Hagan, which resolved it, that certainly was the case. So you have that developed. But I think the attitude generally in enforcement was, just two things come to mind. One was, the cases factually were so compelling that you'd find a theory. That was always the case. And two, because if you had, and that's even in the circumstances of M&A land, because you had this huge profit and people, large trades before. You didn't worry about the 100 share trade, but you had the either large option trade or large security trade. So one was and two was you would conjure up and hunt for duties. Investment bank was easy because of footnote 14 in Dirks, the accountants, lawyers, underwriters, there's sort of be a way. You had this whole and then you had the misappropriation theory. If you steal it, if you had to get it for one purpose, you use it for another. So what evolved was you sort of took what was out there and started using it. So while you worried about it a little bit, you didn't worry about that much because you had compelling facts and you had alternative theories.
Well, you got out of the SEC about the time that the insider trading cases were really, you know, just about to become, you know, headline news.
Yeah.
Did you have knowledge that these kinds of things were in the pipeline?
No. I left in the end of 83, really. The Boesky case, which I was involved in representing him, was in November 86.
Right.
So, I mean, and 84 was Dirks, and sort of, there was a lot of M&A, there was a lot of inside trading. The chairman made it a high priority program, that's Shad.
Yep.
And so we had all that. But I didn't have a sense of the pipeline. The Boesky, the run-of-the-mill insider trading case, even in an M&A context, took on a whole different meaning when you're talking about people with meeting on the street corners of New York with bags full of cash, and you had hidden accounts, and you had, you know, notable people involved in what looked like horrendous conduct. That's really what happened with the Dennis Levine, Boesky, Milken, Goldman, Bob Friedman. You had basically it opened up Wall Street to this in big time, and that was the big thing from, let's say, 85 to 90.
Right. I guess my question would have been: did you have a sense that was might be out there?
No. I didn't have any sense of that.
Everybody in the SEC was a little surprised.
Yeah, well, that was delivered to him. I mean, it made Gary, who took over when Fetters had to leave, Gary took over. Basically, we walked us into the SEC and U.S. Attorney's Office, Boesky. I mean, they were nowhere on that.
Right.
So, I mean, this in that sense, it was a little artificial because they had developed those cases, and the crisis actually brought down Drexel, so that was a huge turn of events. But it was something delivered to them. I don't think they had. They knew about there was trading. They were frustrated because they couldn't get behind it because it was taking place offshore, and they couldn't trace it.
Right. Well, is there anything that we haven't talked about that we should touch on?
I don't think so. I don't know if this has been helpful or not.
Terrific.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Very good.